Whiskey. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Still a good jingle.
I was thinking that as well, yeah.
Hello, welcome to the May 2024 edition of Space Boffins. In partnership with the Naked Scientists, I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. And this time we have two astronauts. NASA astronaut Victor Glover, who's going to pilot the Artemis II mission around the moon later this year. And the space investor who went into space, RIP, just over a week ago, basically, on Blue Origin, the wonderfully named Mason Angel.
You're looking at the Mach meter. It's gradually increasing. You're at Mach 1 and the Mach 2, and you're looking at Mach 3, and you're looking at the altitude, and you're thinking to yourself, not so much blue anymore. It's more black. It's more black. And then you're up there, and it's all black, and it's just void. It's the blackest black I've ever seen. It's the darkest I've ever seen. And truly, it's probably the most alone I've ever felt in my life.
We'll hear more from Mason a little later on, including what it was like to be sharing a spaceflight with none other than Ed Dwight, the first black astronaut selected for NASA, who's had to wait over 60 years to get into space. Honestly, this is one of the best podcasts we've done for a while. These two interviews are really
they
good.
Are good. I think all the others are great, yeah. But it's nice when one sings.
These are really good. So if you're a regular listener to our podcast, you know that we have been covering different aspects of the Artemis moon missions, and we're delighted to have as our guests an astronaut from that program.
Victor Glover, he's a naval aviator, a test pilot and an engineer, and he was first selected as a NASA astronaut in 2013, and he was more recently the pilot of the Crew 1 Dragon spacecraft Resilience, which flew to the International Space Station in 2020. His next mission, though, is a big one. Since due to being named the pilot of NASA's Artemis II mission, he will also become the first black astronaut to go to the moon.
Well, we spoke to Victor just before the first ever Starliner launch, which, as you'll know, that mission was delayed because a small helium leak was found. As we record this podcast, well, the launch is still due to go ahead in the next few days with its crew, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, at the beginning of June. So before discussing his own mission, we began by asking Victor how he felt about Starliner.
I am excited, but the overriding feeling that I have is gratitude for the folks who have worked so hard for so many years to get here, and also just congratulations to those folks. You know, we have lots of big milestones ahead of us, launch, the mission, landing, but this point, just for Butch and Sonny to get up this morning ready to launch, that's a huge step forward. And so I am excited, but more so grateful and want to congratulate all those folks that made it possible.
You trained for Crew Dragon. You flew the second mission of Crew Dragon. How does it compare?
I've trained on Starliner too. I actually did some of the early development testing for Starliner, and they're different. They solve the same problem of getting humans to low Earth orbit to dock with the International Space Station. And so, they're different. The Soyuz is also different in kind. But they all get humans to the space station, and that's what's important. Dragon can get four people up there relatively easily with, the training required for the Dragon is not as intensive. And so for the early missions, we still had test pilots and flight test engineers on those. But that vehicle was designed to be able to be crewed by people who are not professional astronauts, as you're starting to see play out in industry, which is cool. Starliner is more like the space shuttle, similar to Orion, the spacecraft I'm training on now. And those are both designed to be flown by people who have really deep systems knowledge. Just to find the displays, you have to go through multiple pages to get to the right data. And obviously, you know, everybody knows the Dragon is touchscreen and there are very minimal buttons and handles. And Orion and Starliner both have more traditional hand controllers and switches and interfaces. And so those come with benefit, but also weaknesses. You know, Orion and Starliner both have more ways that the crew can mess things up. So we have a higher barrier for training. We have to do more training in order to be proficient with those vehicles.
There's been quite a bit of attention on the design of the spacesuits themselves for Starliner and obviously for Dragon and with SpaceX. Do you have a preference?
the one that I get to wear to space. You know, it's cool that there's so many different ways to solve that problem, you know, to keep your gases gas and your liquids liquid when you're in space. And so the difference, honestly, I would tell you that maybe the biggest thing that jumps out to me is I do like the color blue. I'm a big fan of blue. And so I really like the Starliner suits. But I congratulate SpaceX on coming up with a new way that works. And, you know, David Clark has got a system there that works. And we've got some other companies working on the Orion suit. And all of them are good in their own way. And I like that we have variety. You know, it's kind of cool looking at our crew poster now. And you see all these different types of suits. And we still have people flying Soyuz. And so you see Sokol suits up there, too. Pretty cool.
Was there any competition, you know, friendly, I'm guessing, between the crews, those flying Dragon and those flying Starliner?
Heck yeah. Are you kidding me? Yeah, of course. You know, it's interesting. I heard someone say this. I heard Fred Gregory use this term, so I'm going to borrow it from him. Like, we aren't competing, but there's competition. You know? It's friendly, of course. But I don't know if you remember this, but when the commercial crew announcements, the first crew announcements came out, we had this big to-do, but they did the capture the flag. And so the administrator and the heads of Boeing Space and CEO of SpaceX, they all really started the actual competition in the public's eye. And, you know, they had this race to the docking hatch, the compartment where they would get that American flag that was left up there by the Space Shuttle Atlantis. And so it was also a competition between them. But internally, you know, we work for NASA. We don't work for Boeing or SpaceX. But yeah, we've had a good time nudging each other along, motivating one another.
That's good to hear. What difference will having access to two spacecraft make to NASA?
I don't know, you know, if you use public transportation or you have your own vehicle to get to work, but, you know, it's nice when it rains. I worked in Washington, D.C., and I would ride the metro to work. But every now and then I needed to go and drive, and it was nice to have a parking space outside the Capitol. And so depending on weather or the metro breaking down, it's just nice to have redundancy. And so we have Soyuz to still get us there. We now have the Starliner made by Boeing, and so that gives us ways to ensure we can continue to have humans in low Earth orbit. Human presence in space is a key objective for national space policy, and we're glad to have multiple ways to get there. And I'm happy whenever we can mention that it's great. It's great for Boeing. It's great for NASA, Launch America, all that. That's great. But it's still to support our public-private partnership and our international partnership that is really proven to be so important to not only science in low Earth orbit to help us here on Earth, but also to develop the systems to get us to the moon and onto Mars eventually. You know, Artemis is benefiting from things that we're doing on that space station. So it's good. It really is good to be able to get humans to low Earth orbit in as many ways as we can.
Are we likely to see more private space stations, more private missions?
I certainly hope so. That's a part of our mission, really. The White House, our senior leaders, our Congress leaders have charged us with commercializing low Earth orbit so that we can focus our attentions on deep space, getting back to the moon and eventually on to further parts of our solar system. And so to study our neighbors in the sky, we have to do that. And so I certainly hope so. Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's really neat to share that I did fly on the Dragon. We're here to celebrate Butch and Sonny and the team that made CFT, that's making CFT possible. But our spacecraft, serial number 207, when we landed about 10 miles from here in a place they call Dragonland, they refurbished it, and it was flown by all private astronauts on a mission called Inspiration 4. And I just think that's really amazing. You know, that wasn't a thing a decade ago. And so the fact that that's reality now is it's no longer science fiction.
I mean, there was a lot of criticism, wasn't there, of NASA and the U.S. space program in 2011. I mean, before you were selected, that with the end of the shuttle, there was nothing. There was no means to get to space. Now you've got two means to get to low Earth orbit and potentially with Orion, a third spacecraft. Which is your favorite?
Again, the one that I'm going to fly to space. So, can you see a pattern here? I guess you would call me a fair space weather friend because I don't. You know, but actually to touch on something serious with that, though, it's my job not to have favorites. I mean, Dragon will always, especially serial number 207, we call it resilience, and SpaceX still refers to it as resilience. But it's my job not to have favorites. It's my job not to have blinders, to have a clear-eyed view of the technical, you know, the software, the hardware, but also the team, the people that work so hard to make those technology solutions work. And so it helps me. I can do my best work if I don't have favorites. Now, that's not why you're asking me the question, though, right? For me to talk about my professional code. I mean, I'll say this, you know, the Dragon does look pretty cool. It's a good looking spaceship. The Boeing spaceship's got a lot of really neat capability, and it lands on land. That's cool. And Orion is going to the moon. So, like, you know, here's the thing. I live in a world where, like, favorites, I've got four daughters. Like, I left favorites 21 years ago when we started having kids. But let me tell you something about each of them that I think is amazing. The Boeing Starliner lands on land, and that adds a new capability for us to bring folks back in a way that our public can see and relate to. Landing out at sea, they watch it on the news. But when you can see something streak in and watch it from your backyard, that's going to change the paradigm and engage more people. That's a great strategic impact of the Boeing Starliner. The Dragon has been flying successfully. That's awesome. It's made in California. I'm from California. It's been great for creating jobs in my home state. That is a great thing. I love that. The rocket and the spacecraft were made there. And in the same vein, Orion is made by companies all over America. And the service module is made by a partnership between the European Space Agency and Airbus, you know, in Germany. And so that's really cool that the spacecraft physically represents that international partnership that we're pushing in the Artemis Accords. And so I just love that. All of them have really unique capabilities. And so I don't have favorite spaceships. I have, you know, aspects of each spacecraft that I really like.
Obviously, you will appreciate what Sunny and Butcher, you know, are going through and were going through in the run-up to the Starliner launch. As a test pilot, do you feel any apprehension when you're flying a new spacecraft for the first time, or is it just part of your training, part of your job, or do you still get that little stomach, little sensation?
Yeah, we're not cavalier, you know, wild people who take risks unnecessarily. We understand as much as we can about those risks. And so I think that just makes you humble and sober minded in how we approach them. We are professional risk takers and we do our best to mitigate those risks. But going to space is not risk free. In fact, we would be doing a disservice to our profession and to the public if we made it seem like what we do is routine. When we fly Starliner 10, it will be just as complicated and complex. The fact that we've done it, well, at that point, it'll be 10 times before, because Starliner 1 will be the second crewed mission. Those 10 flights don't get us out of the woods on having to be vigilant. Every flight is almost a miracle that has to happen very precisely. And so what does that turn into inside of us? It makes us focus and work really hard to know what we can know and do what we can do. But at the end of the day, there are places where no matter how well trained you are and how cool hand Luke you can be and calm in the moment, there are things that can get outside of our control. And it's important for people to know that this is dangerous. It is really dangerous. That's why it takes so long for these things to happen. And so none of us treats this, you know, casually, but you train so hard and training does a couple of things. It doesn't just teach you the system. It teaches the system you. Learning the technical and the hardware and software is one piece, but you learn the people you work with, like their grit and determination and resilience, and you learn how well they communicate and you grow together and all of you get better at those things. And that all goes toward the most important component of any space mission, and that's trust. And I would say right now, there can be varying levels of nerves. You know, some of us come from backgrounds where people used to shoot at us, and we flew first flights in the air, and so and some of us come from classrooms and we used to teach. And so varying levels of nerves can be a part of this, you know, phase. But I tell you what, I think Butch and Sonny have a lot of confidence in that team. They know the challenges that they're facing being a first flight. And I think right now, though, they're probably the most calm and ready as they've been in a very long time. This is the nice part. There's a lot of work to get to this point. One of the best things about this is not launch. It's just the calm before launch.
And how is the training going for Artemis?
Slow and steady, slow and steady. And so our lives are really three things right now: training. And since we're the first crew to train, we get the things as they're done. Some of the training doesn't exist, but we're about finished with academic training, the classroom portion, and we're about to start simulations, and that's really cool. Some of them will be even integrated with launch control and mission control, and so that's going to be very exciting. Later this month or next month, that should start. But training is only one facet. It's actually the small third in the three things. So training is one piece. We also do lots of testing. This is a new vehicle, the first time humans are going to be on it. Life support, the waste and hygiene compartment, the exercise device, the displays and controls. Those have never been used for real, and so we're doing lots of testing to minimize risk and unknowns for those systems. So training is one piece. Testing is another, and then this, what we're doing right now, talking. Training, testing, and talking. The public engagement, you know, even with our update to our launch date. I don't like to call it a delay. It's really a correction, adding some reality. That allows us more bandwidth to focus on testing because there's a lot of it going on. Test training, the pace has not changed for training. It's going slow and steady. And the public engagement has calmed down a little bit. But the testing, it allows us to focus more on testing. And I would say things are going very well. We have a lot to do, but it's going very well.
Can I just ask about, you mentioned the waste and hygiene. I always feel I should ask astronauts about space toilets. How does the Artemis one compare to the Dragon one, to the shuttle one, to the ones on the ISS?
Very similar to the shuttle one. On ISS now, we have a toilet. So we have the waste and hygiene compartment, WHC, on ISS. And we also have one that, unbelievably, NASA calls toilet. They didn't even make an acronym. It's just called toilet.
Well, you know. That's not an acronym for something.
Right. And so now the space station is actually now a 7-bedroom, 3-bathroom.
Oh, wow. En suite. Right. Yeah.
And so we got a new crew quarters called CASA in the European lab. And there's the Russian segment, ASU, which is their WHC. And now we have toilet. And so the one in Orion, the waste and hygiene compartment in Orion, is very similar to the WHC on ISS. But the components are more like the compartment that it's in and kind of how you use it, the posture that you'll be in is like ISS. The compartment it's in is very much like, I'm sorry, the hardware itself of the commode and how you put in the containers. The bucket is very much like a space shuttle. And the technology is like an update of space shuttle. It's kind of because our WHC on the ISS is really a U.S. implementation of the Russian ASU. I don't know if that's popular knowledge, but our toilet on ISS, when you put the new pieces in, they're all in Cyrillic. And then we cover it up with panels with English on them, but they're all in Cyrillic. And so our toilet is kind of like modified space shuttle hardware with some updates. And I would say a couple of areas where we maybe stepped backwards. We could have done something a little different, simplified some things, but we'll see how it works in space. I hope it works well. But all toilets in space are, you know, you take away gravity, and so you have to use something to motivate things to go the right way. And so they mostly use airflow. Airflow is the way. It's not like Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini when we just, like, gave you a Ziploc bag and sticky tape and told you good luck. I mean, I'm really glad that we're not doing that. However, if that WHC breaks, we have a way to do that. We have contingency waste options, and so waste management options. And so, but we really hope and pray we don't have to use those.
Now, you mentioned earlier about, you know, the teamwork and how Sonny and Butch, you know, you really get integrated and get to know who you're working with well. Now, I think we did an interview recently. Was it the Japanese or the Chinese that actually go on holiday with each other?
Yeah, they live together. They go on holiday
really
together.
They really do everything together to ensure that bonding. Is that sort of a step too far for the Americans?
No, I bet you they got the idea from us. I don't know when we started it, but you know, they say holiday. I could call this a vacation, but we do something very intentionally in addition to the social things that we do together. A lot of us live very close together and we do spend a lot of time together. When we finished astronaut candidate training, one of my classmates, Drew Morgan, and I, we took our families to Disneyland, like stayed in the same 3-bedroom. I've got 4 kids. He's got 4 kids. And wow, we squished us all into a 3-bedroom. We spend a lot of time together. When we leave work, we don't leave each other, you know, very much like the military in that regard. But we do something, well, I don't even want to bring up the name because I don't want to sound like I'm endorsing, but we do lots of outdoors training that's kind of putting you in a rough situation, but we go to these amazing places, river rafting, sailing, hiking in the mountains, you know, trekking through the desert. And those opportunities are for us to not just learn more about land and, you know, geology and survival, there are also opportunities to learn how each other responds to these varying climates. You know, space is an isolated, confined, extreme environment. And so we go to some of those isolated, confined, extreme environments on the Earth, and we just learn to work together. We learn how each other responds when we're hungry, happy, hot, and cold. And so, but these places are like amazing. I mean, you get to go, and I summited a place called East Temple Peak outside of Lander, Wyoming. And when I did it, I was holding hands with all of my classmates. I mean, it was an amazing thing. So I would say we holiday together, and we do lots of other things together too. We travel together a lot. We have ways to kind of get it. The same thing you do on vacation or holiday, you know, when you kind of get away from home, you change the rules a little bit, change the hats you wear. And, you know, when you're in a different group of people, you can, the relationships change when it's just you, you know, one-on-one, or when it's four instead of eight or 10. And so I think we are very intentional about that time that we spend together with our teams. This thing that we get to do in going to space is much more about people than it is about technology, honestly.
Funny enough, we were literally talking about that before we did this interview, wasn't it? It was about,
well, yeah, because it's something that Tim Peake, British astronaut Tim Peake, has talked a lot about, that he said selection was, you know, 90% how do you get on with people, and about 10% whether you can actually do the job.
Because we were also discussing how probably in our minds, like the original astronauts in the Mercury selection, probably by today's standards, not all of them might have been chosen purely from the people aspect, and possibly the Apollos.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's so much that has changed since then that we can't grade them by too tough of a standard, right? Things are different now. There are a lot of reasons the astronaut office would not look like or sound like it did back then. But also, I would say to you today, even by our own standards that we profess, we would still not, you know, a few of us that are in the office now, I could be one of them, might not have been picked. If we looked at that and really were hard on ourselves, we probably have a person or two now that we go, why did we pick that guy? Ike's kind of grumpy and he's got a resting mean face, you know. But that's the thing. It's a human endeavor, and anything that involves humans brings error into it. And so we also are very good at working that out as well. We learn and grow. And so I think we bring in people who grow. And so even when you look back at Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, those early classes, those single digit classes, those are some fun. I'm listening to Michael Collins Carrying the Fire right now for the second time.
It's a brilliant book. Brilliant book. Yeah.
It is the most brilliant thing written by an astronaut. And I'm sorry, like, you know, I know the Chris Hadfields out there and my buddy Leland Melvin, like, they've written some amazing books. But like, guys, this is the gold standard, man. We're going to hire astronauts again soon, and we're going to buy them copies and tell them, read this first. And it should be required reading for all of NASA, but definitely everyone in the astronaut office.
Have you read Mike Mullane's Riding Rockets as well?
No, I just got it.
That's a very good one as well.
Yeah. But I just don't want to be too hard on that time period, because really, if you're going to be hard on the 50s and 60s astronauts, it should be because of where America was. You should be hard on society at large.
To be fair, we weren't being hard on them. I think we were just sort of, it was an observation of like, oh, you know, the way things have changed, that certain people might, even though obviously they could do it and they did it and they did it well, it's just the criteria is definitely more emphasis on the getting on together as a team. And you can understand why, because they were only going to in the moon, it was just for a couple of days max, whereas the missions are often much longer than that.
You know, that group produced some of our first space station flyers, though. And so, like I said, it's a complicated thing to try to compare them to now. And we do so sometimes for very specific reasons. But it's actually quite impressive how good we were at picking people. I mean, especially the ones that are still alive, they're quite impressive to me. And I really appreciate it. You know, it's interesting. It's an interesting thought experiment, but I would say the same thing about now. If we did this as an academic exercise, some of the people we have in the office right now, we would say we wouldn't pick them. So, you know, you're right. But that's true about today's astronaut office as well, because we're humans and we're flawed.
I was just wondering, you know, psychologically, we've talked a little about the sort of selection and the experience of being an astronaut. I just wonder how different it will be going into deep space, and whether you have any sort of psychological preparation for that when you fly in Artemis 2 beyond the moon. I mean, for the first time since 1972.
Yes, but it isn't really about the destination. Going to the moon is great. I don't know. Ask me that when I get back.
We will.
Okay,
we'll do our best. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how to talk about that, and I don't really try too much because I would just want to be in the moment when I'm there. I'll have the feelings I'm going to have then. But in terms of preparation and psychological, you know, readiness, this going to space is a really challenging thing. And I look, it's harder than it looks. And we don't say that enough. Going to the space station, flying in a free flyer vehicle for several days, it's harder than it looks. And so the thing is we've got a lot of spaceflight experience on the Artemis II crew, but we have big spacecraft experience. We all flew for, you know, several hours to get to the space station. And then we had, you know, large pantries of wet wipes and plastic bags and lots of food, you know, years. We had years worth of food on the space station and a machine that takes old water and turns it into new water. And we don't have that on Orion. We have a tank full of water. And as we drink that water, it's gone. We have food, and as we eat the food, it's gone. No one's sending a resupply ship. So we actually had a meeting with the CFT crew, Butch and Sonny. We sat down and just kind of picked their brains about things, and Butch said something that our crew has repeated a lot. It really set the mindset. It really gave us a healthy mindset, a small spacecraft mentality. We are going to be in Orion. It's our home. It's our work area for the entire mission. Whereas, you know, ISS missions, it's just the transfer. We call them personal transfer vehicles. And so in this one, it's everything. It's the workout place. It's the sleep place. It's the fly the spaceship, you know, hand controllers place. And so that really changes the, you know, there's nowhere to get away from the rest of the crew. There's no such thing as privacy. You have privacy in on the ISS. There's no privacy. You're like, well, you can go in the waste and hygiene compartment and shut the door. And as soon as you flip the machine on, you wake everybody up. It's the loudest thing other than the thrusters, other than the ohms engine. And so there's just no privacy. And so those are the things that are going to require a different set of psychological preparations, and we're getting into that. We are trying to figure out what we need to do, and we're going back and looking at how space shuttle crews prepared, how Apollo crews prepared, Mercury and Gemini, and so those lessons are out there. They're written down. Those folks were very good at documenting what they went through, thankfully.
It's a very exciting time to be with NASA at the moment. I mean, you can tell in your voice. I mean, I think around the world, people are feeling the same, is that it's got its mojo back, and particularly working with all these different companies. Do you feel the same?
Well, I definitely think it's a great time to be here. I think we are coming out of some interesting times. I mean, listen, to have an international space station, which we can fly a SpaceX Crew Dragon. Very soon, humans can fly the Boeing Starliner spaceship, that we can also still fly Soyuz to as well. That's 4 spacecraft. Orion will have humans flying it very soon. And we're working with a team building a lunar lander from SpaceX and Blue Origin and their friends. And it's a great time. Never has NASA done all of these things at the same time. We've done a lot of these things, but not at the same time. It is an amazing time to be here. But I want to mention something. When the shuttle retired, a lot of folks left and we downsized, and Pete, you know, this idea of getting our mojo back, I think something that the public misses, and that I think part of it is because of the way we tell this story, we have not been resting on our laurels. Maybe the media hasn't covered it as much because we don't launch from Kennedy Space Center or Cape Canaveral, which I understand. Launching from Baikonur is not as interesting. But you have human beings now who are 23, very soon 24 years old, that have lived every day of their life with a human in space. And that is really something. That has never before happened in history. This is a unique time, and we should celebrate that. NASA's mojo has never gone anywhere. We have had humans in space continuously. This is an amazing thought. We've had humans in space continuously since November 2nd of 2000. That is amazing. And so, but yes, right now things are different. And I hope we just continue to do so safely. Spaceflight requires eternal vigilance, and that part is also not lost on us.
A very excited Victor Glover. And who can blame him as the NASA astronaut prepares to become part of space history with Artemis II scheduled for launch currently at the end of this year, around November. That's the latest anyway.
He was delightful.
Wasn't he?
You can always tell if someone's a nice person by how they are before and after the interview.
That's true.
And he was great before. I wish we'd recorded our little banter beforehand, which we didn't record. He was lovely in that. NASA said it was a great interview as well.
Do you think they say that to everybody?
Maybe, yeah. But it works for me.
Yes, we'll choose to believe it.
Yeah,
we'll
but he was absolutely delightful, gave us half an hour of his time. And I think you'll agree, it's a great interview.
Yeah, no, I love it. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Now, shortly after our conversation with Victor, Blue Origin sent up 6 new astronauts into space. And you'll recall that they're just suborbital flights, sort of up and back down again. But they included a venture capitalist, a French entrepreneur, a software engineer, a retired accountant, a commercial airline pilot from India, and a 90-year-old sculptor called Ed Dwight.
But as many people discovered, the oldest crew member had an extraordinary earlier career. As in 1961, Dwight was a test pilot and captain in the Air Force, and he was personally selected by President JF Kennedy to become America's first black astronaut.
Well, we know that never happened. And actually, if you want to hear more about that, you can head to our back catalogue and listen to our August 2023 podcast when we speak to the directors of the Space Race documentary about the first black astronaut, Guy Bluford, and those like Ed in the 60s who never made it into space.
So that Blue Origin flight, a bit like Wally Funk's basically, it was rather special with an incredible personal backstory. And one of the other crew members on that flight got to not only have his own amazing experience in space, but share that moment with Dwight himself.
So you're going to hear a conversation with Mason Angel, an investor in space technologies, and he went into space as part of the non-profit organisation Space for Humanity.
Final countdown. Let's turn it over to Mission Control. Let's light this candle.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, command, engine start, 2, 1, 0, ignition.
New Shepard has cleared the tower. The rocket and our astronauts are heading up to space.
Can we just talk about the preparation and training? Because I don't think we maybe know a lot about what goes into a flight with Blue Origin. I mean, how much training do you get? Do they say, here's the spacecraft, here's the exit, here we go.
Are you a size medium or large?
Yes. This is oxygen mask, put that on in case and press that fire button. No. So it's like 3 days ahead of time you arrive, and we ran hundreds of simulations preparing for this launch. And the capsule and Blue Origin did a fantastic job of preparing us for every single anomaly that might occur. That ranged from, you know, going up in a standard flight and you're in the capsule, it's a mock capsule, and let's say there's a fire or something and you have to go through the protocols or we need to escape or rapidly egress. So they prepare us for all this. And I think that's interesting enough. That's where the team and camaraderie comes together, because you arrive, you really don't know each other that well. And the next thing you know, you're training for effectively, I know that people like to use anomaly, but it's a crash. It's an effective crash.
And you were training with Ed Dwight. I mean, did you feel overawed a little bit? Because he's such a legend. He's one of these people that absolutely should have flown in space in the 1960s.
Yeah. I mean, it was wonderful to hear his experience as a test pilot. I mean, what a man, truly. And to hear his experiences that he shared with us, he still has it. I truly hope I have his amount of energy at 90 years old. But he talked about some of the original test pilots that we know and hear about. For instance, you know, Chuck Yeager and Alan Shepard and some of these other individuals. So he's a walking like history museum, effectively, if you want to talk about it like that. But yeah, Ed's a fantastic individual. I was honored to go up with him, and fortunate he lives 10 minutes away from me in Denver.
In terms of your flight itself, go through what you were feeling like from that moment when you were sat in the seat. It wasn't a test run and you're about to go up.
Was terrified. truly, it's because out of my eyes, the corner of my eye, I saw the flare stack for the hydrogen, and it went from, you know, small, I'd say the size of a car, to a massive train rapidly. So you have this huge exhaust plume, and then above you, the ceiling looks like it's on fire because the engines are igniting. It takes some time for the the compression to, you know, expand, and then you're actually going up. So you're sitting there and it says T minus 4, 3, 2, and then the boosters ignite, and you're holding on at that point. You can't stop the rocket. You're just going. So
what did your body feel like, though? Did it sort of reverberate? Did it feel louder than you expected? Did it sort of go through your stomach? What were the physical sensations?
It's somewhat like a roller coaster, truly. And then the real jolts that you feel are on separation, like the booster and the capsule upon reentry when the chutes deploy. So that's the real physical jolts. But you're looking at the Mach meter. It's gradually increasing. And you're at Mach 1 and the Mach 2, and you're looking at Mach 3, and you're looking at the altitude, and you're thinking to yourself, not so much blue anymore. It's more black. It's more black. And then you're up there and it's all black, and it's just void. It's the blackest black I've ever seen. It's the darkest I've ever seen. And truly, it's probably the most alone I've ever felt in my life, just looking up at the void of space. And then I was able to kind of avert my eyes downward and see Earth. And I didn't see a whole lot of curvature, but I saw a little bit. And I saw the vast ocean. I saw the Coriolis effect with the clouds. And I saw small specks of land. It was very warming. It was a great sense of relief to know that in this vast black void is this planet that's beautiful.
William Shatner struck me with how erudite he was afterwards and how emotionally moved by it for quite a long time. Did the emotions kick in for you at that time in itself, or is it such a sort of rush of experience in a relatively short time that certain emotions come afterwards?
It's a great question. I would say that in the immediate excitement, your adrenaline is pumping. You don't have a whole lot of time. And you're thinking about your training too. You do not want to be that individual who doesn't get his harness on. That would be very dangerous. So your adrenaline's pumping, but you're also just enthralled with the excitement and just sharing it with these people. But I would say the most reflection I had was afterwards. And I would say I came back with a huge renewed sense of purpose, just having that perspective. And even Victor afterwards, when I saw him, he shook my hand. He said, for those who have been given much, much will be demanded. And it's a bold Bible verse, but it's very appropriate in that moment. So,
and you mean Victor Glover here, who was waiting at the landing site there. And what a wonderful tribute to Ed Dwight that so many black astronauts were there. And of course, Victor's going to be the pilot on Artemis II.
Leyland as well. There's a few individuals, a former NASA director. He had the biggest cheer zone I've ever seen in my life, which is really. And just see Ed just elated with excitement when he got down. That was a great experience for me as well. And I was the last one to walk out of the capsule. So I got to see everyone kind of take their moment. And then I kind of took a moment to myself inside and just cried a little bit. But it's a great feeling. Blue Origin did a great job of moving us around, and we're taking photos and media and whatnot. But I had a great amount of time to reflect the next day. I woke up especially early. I think it was 4:30 in the morning. And I just kind of put my mind to it, and I wrote some words about my experience.
I mean, you talked about looking up. You've got to look down. You've also got that sensation of weightlessness as well. And all this going on just a few minutes. Did you have time to sort of float around or enjoy it?
Yes. And so they tell you in training, listen, you're going to experience that weightlessness. Do not go inverted immediately. Do not try to do a backflip or front flip. And of course, I did not remember that in the moment. So as soon as my harness came off, I was going for a backflip, and I had to pause myself and focus on a little handle for a second, or else I was going to throw up, which would have been very, very bad. So you're full of excitement, adrenaline. You're smiling with the people. I high-fived the individual next to me, Gopi. It's an amazing experience.
Now, what was your motivation for going into space?
I think as a young man, I still wanted to be an astronaut. And to this day, I mean, I feel as if, again, this purpose is there. I was late to the game. I didn't know much about NASA or any kind of the initiatives that we were going upon until later in my life. So I'd say the purpose of going was to show that to the youth out there that you can be an astronaut in different ways. And I think to enable them to understand that, yes, NASA is the primary director. You know, that's how we get to space. But there's other companies now building access points, and just come back and share that experience with the youth. I mean, again, to Victor, the Artemis missions are coming up soon. NASA should be talking about this 24/7. We should be thrilled with this. My journey has just begun coming down. So now I get to go out and share the gospel, you could say.
And this will be for Space for Humanity as an ambassador. Explain your relationship with them.
So originally the founder, Dylan Taylor, is a mentor of mine, and he has other initiatives. He's the CEO of Voyager Space. But he brought me into this, and he kind of he explained it to me in very simple terms that, yes, you have an opportunity, but you also have a responsibility. And I think working with Space for Humanity has enabled me to actualize that responsibility in a form and a fashion that hopefully I give back more than I take away. So yes, going to space is not cheap, but the idea in my future and what I hope to achieve is to make that accessible for everyone, to bring that price down substantially, to create more infrastructure in space and more readily available kind of opportunities to go there.
And this is really all about the overview effect. I mean, you look at the Space for Humanity website, it just talks about almost every paragraph, the overview effect, you know, that idea of just how it changes you by looking down on the Earth. I mean, would you want, I suppose the answer would be to send world leaders up there, to send leaders in industry up there. Do you think that would change the world for the better?
Or would they see it just as a joyride?
I would hope and pray that they would experience it differently. I think all nations should visit one another. And I think that the easiest way to do that is from space. I mean, if you think about it, if you can put a UN assembly in space and ask them whether or not they'd like to attack the nation next to them as they're viewing it from space, I mean, you can't help but feel some emotion from that. So I think that, yes, in the future, you know, I view myself as a world citizen and then next the US citizen.
And what about a space citizen? Because I mean, looking at your investments, you know, 20 odd space investments in the last 4 years, 48 in total, asteroid mining, fully reusable rockets, navigation
almost
systems.
Almost like a man obsessed with space, isn't it?
Yeah. You must see a value in the space economy. You're not giving your money away. This is investments to make money.
Correct. Yes. And the initiative should be to benefit Earth. So we go to space to benefit Earth. Well, how do we do that? If you think about one of the greatest contributions that US and then also other nations as well, the EU and India and China and a few other nations I'm missing, but they've created global positioning systems that enable us to use all these things for granted. And our modern age is predicated upon space. And, you know, hopefully we can do a better job of communicating that to the youth. And I think the future will enable, if we truly want to, you know, be 3D printing organs in space, or if we want to create an age of autonomy, if we want to be able to have autonomous cars, it's a requisite to have these very elaborate and sophisticated satellites. And in order to get those up there, you need to decrease the cost of actually launching these rockets. And right now, SpaceX is doing a great job at that, but there needs to be more competition.
Do you see that happening? You're not a lone voice, I'm guessing here.
No. And truly, I would be willing, and I am, to dedicate my entire life to that. And I do see a future where there's multiple competition for SpaceX. And that's how we'll all be able to go up there.
And looking back on your experience, what would you say for you was the wow moment? Although I expect every second was a wow moment, but was there, and I mean, you mentioned about seeing that darkness, that sounds mind-blowing. Was that the moment for you, or was there another bit when you thought, oh my goodness, I'm out of the Earth's atmosphere, I'm in space?
I think I wanted to look up first. I wanted to see what space looked like. And I had that perspective, and it was terrifying. Again, when I looked at the Earth, I kind of felt this warm glow in my heart, almost like a mother's warm embrace after being away from home for too long. And that was my moment of my jubilee, you could say. That was my moment of just pure joy.
So why terrified by blackness of space when there's the possibility of other worlds, other humanity, or whatever alien form or extraterrestrial form of life there might be?
Sue, if I could see those planets or stars, I'd probably be excited. And that's where the scientists take over. That's where they're able to create these very clear images for us. But when you're up there and you're looking, you can't see anything. So while you might aspire or hope that they exist in front of you, it does not. But Earth is there in all of its glory and all of its beauty. So I hope we can see more of these other planets, these major, you know, solar systems that we can hopefully venture to in the future. But for now, we have Earth.
And where would you want to go from here?
Pursue a PhD in space resources. And then hopefully aspire to one day work in space, whether that be to command a space station or to work on the moon in some capacity. But, you know, previously I was an investor, and while that's a great role, it's not one that I aspire to in the future. I'd like to be on the ground. I'd like to be an operator with these people and supporting them. But I'm willing to do whatever it is. I'll sweep the floors, whatever it takes to be in the room with these people. They're truly fantastic.
It sounds like, I mean, you must be a fan of For All Mankind.
We're big fans of that.
Because I'm just sort of picturing you on Mars. Maybe maybe sweeping the floors.
No.
I mean, I'll have a big smile on my face the entire time. You know, we have a few things that we need to fix on Earth first. And I think in the near term, here's an ability that we already have. Starlink is available. Kuiper will come up soon. If you can create high bandwidth connectivity all around the world, what's the next step? I think democratizing education is a rational sense. How are you able to do that? I think a combination of an AI tutor of sorts so that you can have a student in any nation experience a Harvard education, and they're able to achieve that. So that's the near-term aspiration that I have. And I think Space for Humanity can play a great part in that.
We wish you the best of luck and hope you get into Commander Space Station.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how envious I am of your experience. So I've done a zero-G flight, as I've never stopped talking about with anyone who'll listen. But yeah, to have that view, yeah, no wonder it was awe-inspiring. So thank you very much for sharing it with us.
You guys might be able to. I think, you know, 10, 15 years from now, the price will substantially drop orders of magnitude. So, you know, while it might be the most expensive vacation you've ever taken, it will be affordable.
Yeah, because there's so much money to be made in podcasting.
That's the irony, isn't it? We love space and so produce a free-to-listen podcast. But if we'd got into finance or become an accountant like one of the crew members, we'd have more chance of going into space. But what an enjoyable chat there with space investor Mason Angel on Space for Humanity and his experience going into space and being on the same flight as Ed Dwight.
Well, I mean, honestly, if Space for Humanity want to send up two of the leading space podcasters, then we're here.
We're right here. Yeah. We're right here.
Speaking of which, a while back, I think we flippantly asked for, you know, you can get in touch via email, on Twitter, social media, made a joke about not being on properly on Instagram. We've had a postcard.
You said, or send a postcard.
And I did
you?
Send a postcard, and we've had a postcard.
Let's see the cover.
From Lanzarote. So a volcano in Lanzarote. Nice volcano in Lanzarote. Dear Sue and Richard, as I was compiling a list of people to send postcards to, I remember there being a request for people to write. So here you go. Isn't that
fabulous.
Lovely? I wish I could say how long I've been listening to you, but I can't remember. I do know that I enjoy it, though. So thank you. And that is from Pinky.
Pinky. Well, thank you, Pinky.
It's great.
Wonderful.
Do send postcards.
Yeah,
we love postcards.
Love it.
That will live in the office for a good while. In fact, I'll put it in the studio here and I'll just prop it up against the light there, and that'll still be there, given that we don't clean the studio in a couple of years' time.
Yeah. Well, that's coming up to it then on our Space Boffins. I think hopefully you've enjoyed it. Two astronauts and...
We set the bar, haven't we?
We have.
Oh, I was going to mention, yes, Earthcare. So in the last podcast?
Was it the last one? Okay.
I think we talked about Earthcare.
Yeah.
This new European Space Agency Earth Observation Mission. It launched the other day successfully in orbit, and you can follow it on the European Space Agency website.
Fabulous.
So that's all good.
And that's it for this month. Space Boffins, do get in touch on Facebook or X or email.
Or send us a postcard.
Or send us a postcard. podcast@spaceboffins.com. And thanks for listening.
Es ist schwierig, Ziele zu erreichen, wenn Ihre Teams keine klaren Prioritäten haben. Mit Asana, der Work-Management-Plattform für Unternehmen, befinden sich Aufgaben und Ziele am selben Ort. Dadurch verstehen Teams, wie ihre Arbeit Ziele unterstützt. Asana, a smarter way to work. Kostenlos unter asana.com testen. asana.com